Water turned pink, clouds of blood spiraling like paint from an artist's brush. I always think of Grace in colours. The purest white to paint her skin. Fine brushes dipped into every shade of gold, brown and red for every strand of hair. I imagine God squeezing a line of emerald paste onto his palette, then changing his mind. Green eyes would be too obvious, and so he chooses chestnut brown instead, dark enough to make her skin look even paler and ignite her hair to flames. It's for the best, I say. Octavia doesn't need to be bothered with every detail. She looks up and smiles at me. It's a smile that says, I won't tell. A smile that shows me we have crossed a line, made a pact. So what shall I do with this? She says, holding out a square of the healing linen which Octavia has breathed her blessing on. She insisted on going to fetch it from my bedroom. Don't worry, I'll be fine. The bleeding's nearly stopped. Dilys, for goodness sake, she says, rolling her eyes playfully. You are not very good at letting people look after you. I could tell her it is because I haven't had much practice. But I don't. Soak the linen first and you can apply it directly to the cut, I say. She hasn't received her daily ration of the healing water yet. Octavia will present her with a square of linen and a wax seal of protection when she takes her vows to Christ. She likes to keep something back. A wedding present, I suppose. Grace fills the second bowl of water and dips the linen in. Like this? Leave it a little longer, it takes time. It's just it looks so... ordinary. For a fleeting moment, I see her eyes widen as though surprised that she has said the words out loud. Does it really work? She says, lowering her voice. We both know that it is blasphemous to question it, and saying something in a whisper does not make it any less dangerous. If anything, it's more because the other person has to lean in close to hear it. Dilys? I realize I haven't answered her. I cannot tell her that the water is my salvation, that it is the only thing that keeps me sane, allows me to think straight, quietens the devil's words. So instead I say, I find it calms my spirits. We know it is a cure-all, a panacea. The Panacea Society, she says, to cure all ills. Have you only just realized? I say with a laugh. She stands up and takes the bowl of ruddy water to the sink. Just when I feel close to Grace, I spoil it. I say the wrong thing or in the wrong way. I thought the name came from the box, the prophecies to heal all suffering, she says. I know I have a lot to learn. I can feel distance opening up between us. Then that's my fault, I say. I should be teaching you about the ministry. How about tomorrow morning? Octavia has asked me to cut the linen. You could bring me some lunch in the cutting room. If that's all right, if you want to, if you're not too busy. She holds my gaze and I know she has come back to me. I'll have to get permission from Octavia, I say. Of course. Then she takes my hand and pats it dry again. Spring is on its way. The garden is full of new life and optimism, nature nourished by the decay of last year's blooms and rising again, reborn, a botanical interpretation of the Bible. How different it must look since God first created it. Since Adam stood and named all the living creatures. I imagine the verdant ferns, the scent of warm rain and teeming life, vines twisting beneath a canopy of leaves in every shade of green, animals with sharp teeth and poisoned fangs. Paradise was dangerous, a place with too many dark corners for the guilty to hide. But it's much more practical as it is today, with open lawns and manicured flowerbeds. Here we shall walk alongside Christ when he returns to us. though I'm not sure what I'll say to him. I expect Octavia will do the talking. It feels good to be outside. Emily is always telling me what will do me good. A good walk, a good meal. She never says a good hiding, but I expect that's what she is thinking. Pain is a good teacher. That's why God punished us with the horrors of childbirth, though old maids are spared that torture. Or is it joy? Yggdrasil wears the delicate lace of new leaves. Narcissi and crocus crowd into the empty spaces between box hedges. I almost imagine I hear the green shoots tearing up through the soil by my feet. But it is Peter. He is using a claw hammer to tease out nails from the wooden hoarding at the back of Castleside. Edgar and Donald are standing, watching him work. "Well, the offer stands," I hear Edgar say as I approach. "Many hands make light work and all that." "I'm quite capable of doing it myself," Peter says with obvious irritation. "It was a task Octavia gave specifically to me."
"As you wish."
They turn from Peter as I pass, Edgar touching his top hat, Donald his trilby.
"Good day to you, Miss Baltrop," Edgar says, stepping forward. "Not at Castleside today?"
Now I'll have to stop and talk. If not, he'll think me rude and will no doubt take out his pocketbook to make a note against me. No, not today, it's Wednesday, my turn to prepare the linen. Besides, I want to stay away until the window has been mended. Kate knew nothing of the broken pane, but promised to let me know as soon as it was done. Until then, I can't risk being alone in the house with workmen around.
"Miss Baltrop, what have you done to your hand?"
It is Donald who speaks now, in a tone that suggests genuine concern. I look down at the bandage that Grace used to bind the tips of two of my fingers. "Oh, it's nothing," I say, putting it into my pocket. "Just a cut. Some broken glass in Castleside."
"I hope you have bathed it in the water,"
he says, glancing at Edgar, who is studying the gold handle of his cane. "Yes, it will be healed in no time, I'm sure. Now I really must get on."
"Of course. Good day, Miss Baltrop," he says.
And as I walk away, I hear him say something to Edgar about the need to be careful. They think of me as a child, unable to look after myself. But Octavia has put me in charge at Castleside. Me, not Edgar. I manage to haul the fabric onto the dressmaker's table in the cutting room. There's a metal measuring tape fixed along its edge. It makes it easier for me to cut the pieces. 1 inch square. That's the standard size for a miracle. Octavia appears in the doorway.
"You look flustered," she says. "Our outward appearance must reflect our soul within."
Perhaps that's why my hair will never lie still. It always looks frazzled. I take my cue and take my leave. She has come to administer the healing, so I leave her to communicate with God. Alone. None of the members has ever seen her perform this miracle. She cannot summon her powers before an audience, only behind closed doors, attended by mystery and ritual. I imagine her, eyes closed, arms raised, an antenna for God's power.
"I am receiving you, loud and clear."
I wonder if it is like tuning in the wireless, crackling and whirring until she can lock onto his frequency. Her body stiffens and she rocks backwards and forwards, her breathing quickening, her pulse racing. Faster and faster. She gasps and then falls slackly against the table. A long exhalation. The linen is imbued, impregnated with the divine, which is trapped in the spaces between the fibres of the fabric. Well, that's how I imagine it works. I am not allowed to find out. I wait instead in the windowless room next door where we keep the archives, shelves piled high with records of our lives. One day we will be recognised as discoverers of the truth. One day scholars will study us, so anything that is written down is catalogued and kept. When Octavia sits down to receive the Lord's instructions at 5:30 every evening,
Her scripts are brought here to be filed, and sealed inside these brown paper packages are our confessions. Twice a month, resident members are required to commit their sins to paper and present them to Octavia in person, but hundreds more send them by post. Every transgression is stored, along with every bill from the greengrocer and baker, every leaflet we print, every rule. Our shopping habits alongside our darkest fantasies. A pound of sugar, a dozen rashers of bacon, greed, envy, vanity. All human life is here. I hear the door of the cutting room and return to find Octavia gone, the air heavy with her influence. The linen can be spread out on the table now. It is off-white like bandages. It makes me think of hospitals and Christ's shroud and the jackets that bind your arms across your chest to stop you hurting yourself. Those who write to us for healing receive one small square cut with pinking shears, which gives each edge the appearance of teeth. I like the way the scissors chew their way across the fabric. I stroke it flat to take out the creases where it has been wrapped around the bolt. It rises up behind my touch, and I roll back another layer to reveal a little more. Soon Grace will come to bring me lunch. Octavia relented. She usually insists that we gather at the dining table, but it is easier if she doesn't have to see me eat, or rather see that I do not eat. So I will take my lunch in here, being careful not to get crumbs on the linen. "Delivery!" Grace says as the door swings open violently. "Sorry, I had to kick it, my hands are full." "You certainly know how to make an entrance. Here, let me." I take a tray from her hands, on it two bowls of soup and two slices of bread. "It was heavier than I thought," she says. "I have brought mine, unless I'm disturbing you." "You are a welcome distraction." I arrange two chairs to overlook the garden. Outside, Peter has made progress with the hoarding, one panel already lying by his feet. He turns to speak to a figure who is bending down to tend the flower bed nearby. It is Emily, using small shears to trim the box hedges back into shape. Last year she had a go at chess pieces, but Octavia said the rooks and pawns looked more like chimney pots, and that the queen was so unkempt that she ought to be beheaded. Since then, Emily has limited all topiary to cubes and spheres. "Did she see you?" I ask Grace. "Emily, did you mention you were coming to me?" They were deep in conversation. "So she didn't ask?" "I don't know why it should bother me. We're not doing anything wrong." But Emily has been making comments lately, making a note of how much time we are spending together. I don't think she likes the thought of me having someone to talk to. "Eat up before it goes cold," Grace says, handing me my bowl as we sit. I take a spoonful and bring it to my mouth, embarrassed at how loudly I draw it off the spoon. I glance up, expecting to find her looking at me in disgust, but she doesn't seem to have noticed. Either that or she is being polite. "So this is it," she says, looking across at the cutting table with a look of fascination. "The linen for the water." She speaks quietly, as if cowed by the presence Octavia has left behind. Relieved to have an excuse to put my soup down, I reach for a pile of letters on the desk behind her. "Yes, we send it to anyone who requests it, and all we ask in return is that they report faithfully on the results. You can help if you like." I begin to read from the one on the top. 81 Woodstock Road, Oxford. "Dear Madam, my sister has become most dangerously ill with heart trouble and a gangrenous foot. She has been miraculously brought back to life, but suffers so much from nerves that mental trouble is feared. Any help would be gratefully received. Yours faithfully, Miss Helen Barr." I pass her the ledger. "So I make a note of her name and address?" she asks. "Exactly, and a brief description. Heart, gangrenous foot, something like that.
and we give each one a GP number. That stands for General Protection. She starts to make a note. This says you are up to 1532 so far. So, Miss Barr is 1533. Look at this one. 4 Church Avenue, Bristol. Will you kindly send me a linen section for divine healing as sent to my sister? My complaint is chilblains, nerves, and also my ears discharge. Thank you in anticipation. Yours faithfully, Miss M. Saunders. We both burst out laughing. Don't be wicked, she says, trying to make her face wear a sterner expression. Poor Miss Saunders. Chilblains are no laughing matter. We carry on together, Grace recording the letters while I go back to cutting the linen. What about the method? She asks. Are there different doses for different complaints? Surely chilblains would need a different preparation from, say, rheumatism. I walk to the cupboard to get a leaflet. I feel her watching me. We send out instructions, I say. Here. Divine deliverance, slow but sure, and human obedience. Instructions to prepare the water for all internal complaints. Hold the linen section, which will never lose its virtue, in a wine glass of water while you count to 12. Oh, but you must say the words, I ask for divine healing by water and the spirit, I explain. It can be drunk or sponged onto injuries. We found it works best for people with coughs or breathing problems if they inhale it as steam. Or you can bathe in it for spinal cases or rickets. She takes the leaflet from my hand and studies it. And people write for help from all over the world. Yes. From India. I know what she is getting at. She is talking about my letter. From Adrian. But this time I am ready. I've had a chance to prepare exactly what I will tell her. And what I will not. We do send the healing to India, yes. Why do you ask? That letter I found at the foot of the stairs. It was from my brother. She looks up from the leaflet. Your brother? Adrian, yes. I see, she says. It's just you seemed... He used to be part of the society, like me, but he left. He renounced his faith. Oh. Grace moves to touch my arm, but changes her mind. I'm sorry. I understand now why you seemed upset. It must be heartbreaking to see him turn away from the truth. It is. I wonder now if he was ever a true believer. After the war, he said it all made sense. That Octavia would make sure that all that suffering would never happen again. But as time went on, he started to question it. To question her. Why was there still so much pain, so much damage? When he was offered a posting to India, he took it. He chose to move far away from all this. Far away from me. Do you think he'll change his mind? Not now. I have stopped writing back to him. There's nothing more I can do. But Octavia says those who turn away from her are the worst of sinners. Because they have a choice, I say. There are those who have not yet heard the truth. But on the day of judgment, Adrian can't pretend he didn't know. He can't say she didn't warn him. None of us can say that. Perhaps God will show him, help him overcome his doubts. I say nothing, moving back to the table and picking up the shears to cut another strip of linen. Because I've been thinking about that first day I came to visit. In the chapel, do you remember? I smile. I can't help it. Sometimes I get the same feeling, she says, tidying the crockery onto the tray. As if all this... As if this place has chosen me. I feel I have started down a road and I don't know where it will take me.
Taking up the long strip of linen I have cut, I begin to trim it into smaller pieces. Healing is a power Octavia discovered quite by accident. She was taking a pill for one of her headaches. It was resting in her palm, and as she said her usual prayer, the tablet was flicked out of her hand. She knew God meant her just to drink the water, and she was cured. I cut the last square of fabric and lift it to my lips with barely a touch. Faith is enough, I say. That's what I want to believe, because it's all I have. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Grace leaves the room with two soup bowls, hers empty, mine full, and a square of linen in the pocket of her apron. A gift I had no right to give. I wait for Octavia to appear in the doorway and tell me I am no good. I wait for the familiar feeling of guilt and shame to creep across my skin. But it doesn't come, and nor does she. I should be sorry, but I am not. We are sharing something, something the others do not know. We are planting a seed of friendship in the dark soil of a secret, where no eyes can spy, where everyone is blind. The Wireless Room. I shall join the others tonight, out in the wireless room where Octavia invites members to sit with her after supper. Designing it was one of her projects. She decided we should have a place to meet and mingle in the evenings, a communal sitting room of sorts. From the outside it resembles a large storage shed, but she has furnished the inside with every comfort befitting ladies of our station, wicker chairs, pot plants, and an air of middle-class judgment. And this evening she is holding court herself, sitting forward on her chair while Peter rearranges the cushion at her back. Rachel Fox is beside her, an unusually tall woman with an unusually high opinion of herself. Her hair is completely colourless, the bright white of someone who looks as though she must have suffered a shock. One of the newer members, Miss Tweedy, a portly woman with an unfortunate nose, is tuning in the wireless. And tucked into a corner, Ellen Oliver sits with a blanket across her knees. The group is silent when I step in, and Octavia greets me with a look that means she expects the same from me. An irritated wave of her hand instructs me to hurry up and sit down. Quietly. A wave of the other bids Miss Tweedy to turn up the volume dial on the wireless. At times, Octavia resembles a sideshow illusionist. She can make objects, in her case people, move at will. Even the announcer's voice appears to jump to attention as she leans in towards the lacquered oak cabinet. The BBC News. Negotiations between the mine owners and the Miners' Federation of Great Britain have failed to reach an agreement about working hours and wages. It is what she has been waiting for. Just as I foretold, she says, the poison of Bolshevism is seeping into our great land. She speaks into the wireless as if it were a microphone, as though she is addressing the nation herself. At present, the mailed fist still wears the soft glove of humanity, hiding behind the pretense of fairness and justice to miners. But do not be fooled. This is Satan's fight. She prepares profound statements to use at times like these. It is just as well that Octavia is so engrossed. Perhaps she will not hear Miss Tweedy, slack-jawed and breathing noisily through her mouth, a habit she will have to change, and quickly, if she intends to stay in the society. I had thought of sending word to the Prime Minister, Octavia goes on, to warn him this would happen, but as Emily says, I am at the helm of my own vessel, not the ship of state. I wonder if her maritime analogy was inspired by the outfit she was wearing this evening. A navy dress with a white lace sailor collar and knot. Peter, that cushion is still not right. She casts a brief glance over her shoulder, then continues her address. Alas, I cannot help these men. They have to help themselves, though they choose not to. She is talking about the bishops. She wrote again to insist that they come and open the box, but the majority didn't bother to reply, and those who did answered only with a request that she cease all further communication. Well, they had their chance. She sits back suddenly. Peter, too slow to withdraw his hands from the cushion, finds them momentarily trapped against the chair. Octavia's irritated tut brings colour to his cheeks. The downfall of men's rule has begun, she continues. There is no way, except by letting loose the hordes, that the devils may be seen for what they are. Now the bishops will begin to fear, won't they? I assume this is a rhetorical question, as Octavia's so often are, but Emily doesn't miss the opportunity to agree. It is just a question of time, Octavia. Peter and I were saying as much this morning, weren't we? I see her give him an encouraging nod and mouth the words, "Go on." Indeed we were, he says. And when I think of the way the bishops dismiss you, Octavia, their arrogance... Do not fear, they will come round soon enough. I only wish they were all as sensible as you, Peter. If they had a grain of your wisdom, they would accept the truth. But the male of the species is predisposed to arrogance. You are the exception rather than the rule. A smile spreads across Peter's face, which blushes an even deeper shade. I see him glance at Emily. Then all eyes are drawn to the sound of the door opening. Grace steps through it, carrying a cup which she sets down next to Octavia. Thank you, Octavia says, without taking her eyes from the radio set. You should stay and listen to this. It is a lesson to us all. Grace knows by now that this is an instruction, not a suggestion, so she stands beside her, hands locked politely behind her back, head tilted towards the wireless. But like the rest of us, she can't hear the voice on the radio. Octavia is not giving her a chance. Look at Bourneville, Port Sunlight, Octavia says. So much has been done for the bettering of the conditions of the employees. They should work all the harder to recompense employers. Some must rule and some be ruled, and they should be perfectly happy with that. She lifts her hand to silence us, though she is the only one who's talking, and the voice confirms that she was right all along. The TUC is threatening to hold a general strike, the radio announcer says. Inevitable, Octavia shrugs. Just as God told me. She looks around the room. I shall take my Coco to bed. With that, she attempts a dramatic exit, but it takes her several pushes to lift herself from the Lloyd Loom chair, and by the time she makes it onto her feet, the effect is rather lost. Good night, all, she says, and don't stay up too late. Several of you are looking rather tired and drawn. Jesus could be back at any moment, and he will be gazing upon these faces. She waves her hand to include us all. You may not be able to greet him with a clear conscience, but a clear complexion is certainly achievable. She stands and lifts her cup, Peter hurrying to the door to open it for her. I'll see you back across the garden, Octavia, he says. There's silence as they step out into the darkness. Miss Tweedy turns off the wireless. Rachel Fox brings a hand up to her face, and I see her dab the head of a particularly angry pimple on her cheek. I don't believe we have been introduced, she says, surveying Grace. Grace Hardwick, pleased to meet you, and you must be... She knows very well who Rachel is. I pointed her out from the window soon after Grace arrived, and drew a caricature with words. I've always thought Rachel's eyes are rather too small for her face. Octavia says she is prone to wearing ugly hats, and of course she has told her so. Grace smiled when I told her that, which is what I was hoping for all along. Me? Oh, I am Rachel Fox. Miss Rachel Fox. Rather old to be a miss, I know, but that is what I am. She arches an eyebrow. Just one. Ah, yes, now I think of it. Octavia introduced you in chapel, didn't she? I had no idea you had become a member of our little society.
Which street have you bought in?
She knows Grace has not bought a house. She knows she could not afford to. But Grace greets her contempt with a warmth that almost fools me.
I'm afraid you are mistaken, Miss Fox, she says, her confidence unfaltering. Octavia has kindly given me lodging, and I am helping in her household.
Rachel looks at her in amusement, a tomcat toying with a mouse.
You could come and work for me, she says. I am always looking out for pious young ladies to help around the house. But, no, what am I saying? You wouldn't want to stoop so low. You are handmaid to the daughter of God.
She puts her hand on my arm.
And to her daughter, too. Dillis, I've always meant to ask, does that make you the granddaughter of God? I suppose it must.
I step back to avoid her touch and feel colour staining my cheeks. I want to slap Rachel across the face and call her a liar. I want to twist her arm until she tells Grace it was a joke, until she says that I'm not really Octavia's daughter. But it is not a joke. And now Grace knows the truth. I should have told her. I should have told her myself.
Well, an honour to meet you, Miss Hardwick, says Rachel. I do hope I'll have the pleasure again soon.
She leaves the room, victorious. Satisfied that she has succeeded in embarrassing Grace, unaware that I am the one she has shamed. Grace, I say, standing up beside her near the open doorway, but she doesn't turn to look at me. We stand in silence and watch Rachel disappear into the darkness.
Grace, I whisper,
but she doesn't acknowledge that she has heard, stepping out into the garden without bidding me good night.
Wait, can we...
She doesn't stop.
Dillis, are you quite all right? Says a voice behind me.
Ellen's voice. I had forgotten there was anyone else here.
You look rather flushed, she says. Perhaps you should get a breath of fresh air. Miss Tweedy will keep me company.
I'm fine, Ellen.
You go.
Perhaps she is right. If I am quick, I can catch up with Grace before she gets back to the house. But after I shut the door behind me, I can't see her. I can't see much of anything at all. The moon and the stars have fled.
Grace!
I whisper.
Grace!
But I hear nothing in reply. I feel my way along the wall, testing the ground with each foot before I step forward.
Grace, are you there?
There's a movement in the clouds, the sweep of a sable cloak revealing a moonlight lining. And I see her stepping out from around the corner of the chapel.
Why didn't you tell me?
She is looking straight at me, but I can't bring myself to meet her eyes. I focus instead on her mouth. Her lips are slightly open, her breathing quick.
Why didn't you tell me, Dillis?
I don't know.
Octavia's daughter. That is something to be proud of, isn't it?
Yes, of course.
Then why?
Right now I can't think of a good reason, a good excuse, so I tell her the truth.
Because that's all I am, I say. To the others, I'm Octavia's daughter.
When you met me, I was just Dillis.
Did you think I wouldn't find out?
I don't know. I hoped we would become friends.
We did, didn't we?
Time went on and it was too late. I am not going to cry. I stopped doing that long ago. It doesn't do any good, and Octavia can't bear it. The sound of snivelling drives her to distraction.
It didn't feel like a lie, Grace. She is not my mother, not any more. My mother was called Mabel.
She went away when I was a child, and then again when I was 17. She went away, and Octavia came back in her place.
What do you mean? You aren't making any sense.
My mother wasn't well, I say. She was in hospital.
The headaches?
Yes, partly. I still can't bring myself to look straight at her. She was away a while. It changed her. It changed things between us. She sighs.
I just feel you've been conspiring somehow.
Conspiring? Not one of you said. Not Octavia, not Emily. We're all told we must confess, tell the truth about ourselves, about other people. What else haven't you told me?
Only the things that are forbidden. The past that Octavia says is best forgotten.
Dilys?
She dips down, finding my eyes with hers.
What else?
Nothing, I say. But that is not true.
There's nothing else.
I concentrate on believing it so I don't give myself away.
Finding out like that, it made me look foolish, she says. I thought we were close.
We are. But all this time I would never have guessed. She doesn't acknowledge your...
You never call her mother.
No, I call her Octavia, the eighth prophet, just like everyone else. Because to her I am just like everyone else. Or perhaps she wishes I was, but I'm a disappointment. I have to turn away now. I look across the garden towards Yggdrasil, but its branches have been swallowed up by the night.
A disappointment,
she whispers in the darkness.
Is that what you... You are not a disappointment, Dilys. You could never be.
I want to believe her. Perhaps she believes it herself, but she doesn't know the truth about me. I have never had the gifts the others do. Or the faith. I try every day. I try to be better. But I always fail.
You don't understand, I say.
No, not if you don't let me. You should have told me the truth. It is no longer anger I hear in her voice. The moon has disappeared again. The chimney pots of Castleside barely visible against the great wave of cloud that looms above it.
Grace, did you see that?
What?
Up in the window.
I reach out for her arm.
In Castleside.
I see a flash of light blink from the room at the very top. But just as quickly it goes dark again, as if the house has drawn its eyelids tightly shut.
You're changing the subject, she says.
I'm not. I saw something.
I think I did, but now I am not so sure.
I saw a light. She looks across to Castleside and shakes her head.
Dilys, there's nothing there. I'm sorry, but I can't.
Finding out like this... There's so much to take in. I need to get to bed. She lifts my hand from her arm and walks away.
I'll see you tomorrow. Good night.
I should go after her, but I am too much of a coward. I don't want to talk about the past. She might start to wonder if I am like Octavia. And I am not. She hears the voice of God, but only the devil takes the time to whisper in my ear. Instead, I stand and watch the top window of Castleside. Perhaps she was right. Perhaps I was just trying to change the subject. Perhaps I didn't see a flash of light at all.
Pull up a chair beside me, Ellen says when I return to the wireless room. You look like you need to sit down.
With the rest, I can pretend, but not with her.
You really don't look well, she says.
And I wonder whether she has seen herself in a mirror lately. Whether she can see what the rest of us can. The pale skin, the thinning hair. The blanket has been tucked so tightly around her knees that I doubt she'd have the strength to free herself from it.
Thank you for looking after me, but Dilys will take over now, she says, smiling kindly at Miss Tweedy,
who puts down the copy of the Radio Times she is reading and bids us good night. Ellen waits a moment after she leaves, busying herself by tucking the blanket even more tightly around her legs.
Now, just the two of us, she says, looking appraisingly at the furniture around us, as if it is her first visit to the room. Tell me, how is Miss Hardwick settling in?
I do not answer.
It must be quite a tonic for you to have someone your own age to speak to, she says. Us old-timers can't be much company.
I should speak. My silence is giving me away, but I don't want to share grace with anyone. Not even Ellen.
It's only natural you want to protect her, she says.
The truth is I want her to protect me, but I don't say that.
It was wrong of Rachel to embarrass her like that, I say instead. It was on my invitation that she came to join us. I feel responsible for her.
Now Ellen is silent, waiting for me to reveal more.
I can't explain exactly, but I think it is important that she stays, I say. Important to the society, I mean. I believe she has a part to play.
Then you must keep her close, if it is God's will.
I reach for something in my pocket, the button Grace dropped outside the Bunyan Meeting Church. I have started carrying it like a talisman, squeezing it in my hand.
God has never singled me out before. I am not...
You are not Octavia. None of us are.
Ellen speaks to the empty room rather than to me.
It is not easy to live in her shadow. But we are all part of God's plan, and perhaps, as you believe, Grace is too.
I nod.
I think it is time for me to retire, she says, taking the blanket from her knees with some difficulty.
I stand up and help her, offering my arm to pull her gently from the seat. She is made only of air, so frail, so fragile. She walks as if there is ice underfoot. One slip and she would shatter into a thousand pieces. But at least we can see our way across the lawn. The moon has emerged again from behind the clouds, painting our path silver. I look across to Castleside again, and the cold air of the garden rouses the nerves on my skin, sensitive enough to feel the gentlest squeeze of Ellen's thin fingers on my arm.
Why don't you stand up to them, Ellen? It should be your feet that Octavia is washing, not theirs.
It is what I have been wondering for a long time.
I am tired, Dillis. Let Emily and the others have their day. I have but one battle, to fight the good fight of faith. Octavia is right. It is nearly time for the Lord to return. That's what matters. It is the only thing that matters. We just have to bide our time a little longer.
We reach her back door and she stops to look at me.
We are the spinsters, the old maids. We are despised by the world, but not by the Lord. In him we have been glorified. He has promised that we shall not die. We shall live here in the garden until he returns to us here.
I can see her eyes shining, light catching on a film of tears.
It won't be long now, will it, Dillis? It can't be long now.
No, of course not, Ellen. It is nearly time.
We must keep faith, she says, and have the courage of our conviction.
The word makes me think of criminals and cells. I look towards the high wall of the garden. Are we imprisoned by our own beliefs? We are convinced. We are convicted. There is a figure and silhouette in the doorway. I unhook Ellen's arm from mine and hand it to Betty, like the father of the bride passing a daughter to her new master. Good night, Ellen. She puts her arms around me and kisses my cheek softly. An embrace from a ghost.
Good night, Dillis. Soon he will come and these old bones shall be revived. Sleep well, my dear.
By the time I get back to number 12, Octavia's empty cup has been washed and is standing on its rim by the kitchen sink. Grace has gone to bed. I pause on the landing, hoping she will hear the floorboard creak and that I'll hear her footsteps behind the door. It has become a signal between us. The way we say goodnight. The house is our messenger, whispering things we dare not say out loud. But tonight she does not hear it speak, or she has chosen to ignore it.
There is no chink of light seeping out from beneath her door, and I imagine her lying in bed in the dark. Should I turn the handle and let myself in? Sit at the foot of her bed and explain why I didn't tell her? No, I mustn't do that. I creep into my own room instead and climb under the blanket. I concentrate on the cold of the pillow against my cheek and reach my hand beneath it. There's a note. Can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion for the child she has born? Though she may forget, I will not forget thee. Isaiah. Chapter 49, verse 15. Talking Pictures. I have left number 12 for the evening, left Octavia and Emily, and the letter that arrived from my brother in the morning post. I left them behind the walls of the garden. The sky is perfectly clear tonight, a legion of stars shining unchallenged on a cloudless sky. A breeze has shattered the black glass of the river, and where the moonlight touches the surface it looks like a host of flapping wings, like flocks of doves. Grace is beside me. We are walking in the warm glare of the street lights and the dark silences between. I thought Octavia was going to say I couldn't come, she says. Only if you hadn't got all your work done. All members are allowed to go, as long as she has approved the film in advance. There are a dozen of us heading out to the Regal tonight. We still have to be careful. We are still being watched, but only by each other. Without Octavia or Emily, everyone feels more relaxed, almost giddy. We can pretend we are just an ordinary group of respectable ladies. Octavia thinks it's important that we are spotted around town at least once a week, browsing the shops on the high street or buying flowers on the market. Sometimes groups of followers will meet at a cafe for tea or take a picnic to the riverbank. That is when we might engage a passerby in conversation, mention the society, give them a pamphlet. We need to be seen to be approachable and acceptable. Though, of course, in reality, we are neither. I love the talking pictures, Grace says, squeezing the top of my arm. Does she feel me twitch when she moves her hand away? So does Octavia. Well, she used to. She hasn't seen a talkie. She hasn't been to the cinema since... It's too far. She can't risk it, not now she knows Apollyon is waiting. But she used to love to go. I told Grace soon after she came to live with us why Octavia mustn't stray from the garden. That's when I should have told her that she is my mother. Or used to be. It has been 2 weeks since she found out, but she has never mentioned it, nor have I. It is another of our unspoken pacts. Tonight we'll be in a theatre full of people, but we will be together, sharing the story, taken off into another world where we've never heard the name Octavia, where we can live in ignorance of the truth. The thought of it makes me feel calm and anxious at the same time. There are butterflies in my stomach, a fluttering of vivid colours, and amongst them the dull wings of moths beating a rhythm of dread. "Gertrude, do keep up!" Kate Firth calls back to one of our number who has fallen behind to adjust the ankle strap on her shoe. Her instruction causes a moment of confusion, since there are two Gertrudes with us tonight. Gertrude Hill is a thin-lipped woman who carries her shoulders so high that her neck quite disappears inside her collars. She is the only non-resident apostle, given special dispensation to live outside the garden because she has a husband who is still alive. She is fond of telling us how busy she is kept as a vicar's wife, though Octavia has hinted that it is her duties after dark that are proving exhausting. He expects her to perform them nightly and with vigour. The other Gertrude, Searson, needs no excuse to avoid conjugal chores. She is estranged from her husband and answers to no one now. Except Octavia, of course. She is wearing a large feather on her silk hat tonight, black like Sir Jack's plumage. And added to the effect of her large teeth, it makes her look a little like a funeral horse. It's good to get out, isn't it?
Grace says as we reach the Swan Hotel lit up on the corner. It is. I think of Adrian's latest letter, folded neatly with the rest, each of them the same. Accusations against Octavia. Pleas for me to leave. This time he wrote about the months we spent together when Mother was away in hospital, and the day that she came home again. He said that was the moment everything changed and that he could see now how wrong it all was. It was bad enough when it was just the devil whispering in my ear. At least I could drown him out with hymns and prayers and sermons. But doubts are more difficult to ignore when they are written down in black and white. Best that I hide his letter away in the box at the back of my wardrobe. Best that I get out of the house. We turn right into the high street. It looks so different at night. The shops are sleeping, shutters pulled down over empty shelves. A group of men look as though they are on their way to a public house. A lone figure appears to be on his way back from one. A car horn makes him jump back onto the pavement as he staggers into the path of two headlights. "You must have taken all this for granted before," I say. "You could come and go as you wished." "Yes, I suppose I could, but I rarely did. I didn't have the money, really. Or the company." She squeezes my arm again. "Do you miss it, though?" "No, it wasn't easy. I was alone. And lonely." I turn to her and she answers, but only with her eyes. I follow the disc of light thrown from the usher's torch and squeeze past strangers, feeling exposed and clumsy. It's not until I'm safely in my seat that my eyes adjust. I see a couple stealing a kiss in the corner, and a lady in an elegant cloche wiping her nose on the back of her sleeve. People get a full sense of security in the dark. They think they are invisible, so they forget to hide. A young man stumbles on a stair as he tries to find his seat, and Grace and I stifle a giggle at his expense. The seats are crimson velvet, and there are drapes either side of the screen. It makes me think of music hall and dancing girls and the back street theatres that Octavia reads about in the newspapers. "Bolt holes of debauchery. Beautiful on the surface, but rotten to the core." I love the extravagance. The red, the gold, the darkness. But I must remember that Octavia has sent us here for moral instruction. The Scarlet Letter, that's what we've come to see. It's about the Puritans and the scandal of an illegitimate child. Octavia liked the sound of that. A good moral tale about the wages of sin. When we mentioned it after lunch, she became quite animated, talking about the Puritans' attitude to sexual relations and the fact they used to have intercourse through a hole in a sheet. I couldn't work out whether she found the idea disdainful or impressive. But she liked the sound of the film all the same. She is surprisingly open-minded when it comes to her choices. She'll even sign off on a love story to remind us that we are better off without the complications of men. Celibacy is not just a requirement. It is a liberation. Watching a woman mooning over her sweetheart looks so ridiculous when you are a bride of Christ himself. She likes us to tell her all about it when we get home, so she can tut and roll her eyes with the moral superiority she would have enjoyed from a cinema seat. Grace's face is glowing, reflecting the flickering light of the screen. If I turn my head a little, I can watch her. When you are in the dark, your eyes work better that way. Astronomers searching for a faint object in the sky will always look slightly to the side. And right now I dare not look directly at Grace. It would be like staring straight at the sun. I move my eyes down to her fingers, which are knotted together in her lap. I look at the fabric of her skirt, which sits on the top of her legs and falls over the edge of her knees. I don't often get to study her as closely as this. I grip onto the corners of my chair. On the screen, the heroine is being led onto a wooden platform and is refusing to tell the baying crowd who the father of her baby is. They force her to wear her shame, a scarlet letter, on the front of her dress. A for adultery.
Grace shuffles in her chair and moves her hand down beside her leg. It is touching mine. I don't move away. I'm not sure I could, even if I wanted to. So there it stays. Our hands are still touching when we learn that it is the preacher who has fathered the child. And while we watch him, tormented by his cowardice and hypocrisy, I press the side of my hand against hers, ever so gently. By the time he stands and confesses his sin to the congregation, our little fingers are intertwined. It's as if I have no feeling in any other part of my body, every nerve and every sensation alive only in the skin that's touching hers. I am Michelangelo's Adam being brought to life with a fingertip, God reaching down from the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel and jolting me into consciousness. Caught up together, in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. First Book of Thessalonians, chapter 4, verse 17. Will this be how it feels when Jesus returns to us? The rapture of salvation. I have seen the others performing the laying on of hands in chapel, and now I understand. I can feel the Spirit flowing through Grace. I am drowning. Drowning in the light. As the film comes to an end, she squeezes my hand, then moves it away, and immediately the heat in my fingers is gone. And all I can think of is Elisha, and how he brought a child back to life. And he put his mouth upon his mouth, and his eyes upon his eyes, and his hands upon his hands, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. Second Book of Kings, chapter 4, verse 34. Woken from death. Voices. Octavia always says the devil is jealous. He wants to tarnish anything that reflects the glory of God, blacken anything that shines with love. And since Grace came, that's me. That's why he is watching me. That's why he is trying to twist and turn my thoughts. I know what I saw. A face, looking in through the window at Castleside. Not one of the others. Not a lady with a pocketbook and pen. Not Peter or Edgar. This was a face I didn't recognize. But I knew right away what it meant. I don't know how long it had been spying or whether it had a body attached. I was working much later than usual, drawing up the latest list for Octavia to read out in chapel, a request for linen for the bishops, more pillowcases, napkins and towels. When I looked up from my desk, night was pulling a curtain of darkness across the bare windows, the panes fading to black mirrors, reflecting my own image within their frames. And when I snuffed out the desk lamp, I saw it. Another face merged with my own. A face pressed to the window, a hand held above the eyebrows. It looked just like the face of a man. It had no horns or scales or claws. But I was not fooled. I know it was the devil that I saw. I know it was the devil who called my name through the glass. I cried out for God's protection, and the face turned.